listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is 0.5% better. I'm Scott Phillips, and he is Andrew Page, the founder and managing director of Strawman.com. Mr. Page, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Half a percent or 50 basis points?
Exact. Yes, correct. We'll get into that in a second. It is morning when we're recording. We're recording this on Thursday morning, of course. It is Friday afternoon while you're listening to this. He is Andrew Page, as I said, and Strawman.com is?
Online private investing club.
Knock me down with a feather. The Motley Fool, you can get to it, fool.com too. Fool.com.au in Australia, I should say. Mate, let's go to that very, very topic. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get straight into it. 50 basis points, half a percent, 0.5%. You asked the question, what is the right answer?
It depends how smart you want to sound. I guess I could
just say... Very is always the answer.
I actually saw the best explanation I saw on Twitter recently was from Elise Morgan from the ABC, and she said, well, you can't say half a percent higher because, you know, if where were we before? We were at 0.35, so half a percent of 0.35. So kind of it's a mathematical answer. So they say basis points instead, basis point being 0.01 of a percent. 0.1 of a percent. So, everyone gets what we're talking about. It's just a bit funny. It's like the only sort of area that we use the term basis points and not percentages.
It is, and we sound very smart when we do it, as you say,
because it's one of those jargon things.
And just quietly, the finance industry very good at that. You're of course, dead right. I saw a funny interaction on Twitter about that, actually. I didn't see Elisa's tweet, but plenty of people talking about the same thing. And someone said, well, it's obviously 50 basis points. And someone else said, yeah, but I write for readers. I thought they're both kind of interesting, right? Because if you say rates are up half a percent, everyone knows exactly what you mean.
Yep.
And so mathematically, Elise is of course dead right. It is of course, you know, as you say, if your bill goes up half a percent, you go from $100 to $100.50. That's not what the bill is going to go up by, right? That's not how it's going to work. It is going to go from $100 to whatever the new number is, because the interest rate is going, as you say, from 0.35 to 0.85, which is 50 basis points. I like 0.5 percentage points. I kind of try and
that's
split
nice.
The difference there, because it's not basically, it's just basis points is like, you know, if you know it, you know it. If you don't know it, you kind of sound probably like, you know, other people sound impressed. You feel a bit dumb, and no one really learns anything. And yes, you know, you just, as you say, you're showing how smart you are, how you know the lingo and the language. I think everyone knows what half a percent is, but I try half, you know, a half a percentage point increase, which talks to, as you say, the structure, the quantum of the increase, not the, you know, percentage of the amount we started with. But
or just extend the sentence.
Yeah,
say increase by half a percent to 0.85%.
Right. That
leaves no ambiguity. The other thing that's kind of funny as well is that it's for the longest time, it was always done in a quarter of a percent movements or multiples of a quarter of a percent.
Yeah.
And the official rate was always some whole number multiple of that.
Yeah, that's right.
And so we've gotten away from that. So I think a lot of people were sort of calling for a funny level increase so we could get back to
so get back to it. Yeah.
We love round numbers, or, you know, more round numbers. And again, it's completely abstract, but it is funny that people have firm opinions on these things. But what does it mean? What does it mean, though? This is the question here. It's kind of, there's a lot of hand-wringing.
That's right.
Lots of hand-wringing, a lot of jumping up and down. It's just sort of like, well, you know, I noticed the other day the Kiwis are at 2%. Mm-hmm. You know, we're at 0.85%.
Yeah,
still correct. Feels pretty low to me. And also, if you take the market estimate, you know, people are sort of looking at an official rate with a 3 in front of it in the not-too-distant future. So it's kind of like, I should probably get used to it, right? In fact, not only will there be almost certainly more increases, but there could very well be more of a increases of this magnitude, of the 50 basis point variety.
Or half a percentage point. So here, and you're right, so a couple of things. You're right about the averages. That being said, the last two rate rises have been 0.25 and 0.5. So as much as we're getting away from numbers ending in equal quarters, the RBA still can't quite bring itself to stop increasing in multiples of a quarter of a percent. So we're kind of, you know, on one hand, we've solved half the problem. The other hand, they kind of can't help themselves. It could be 0.48 or 0.63 or, you know, but no, it's 0.25.
That's why the next 0.5. The next one has to be a 0.4% increase. It's just get us back on track.
Just a really mess with this, exactly. So we'll see what they do. I got to say, mate, without getting too hysteric about it, because it's very early in the podcast, so we've got a lot to talk about. But there is, you know, human nature. Economics is, I was thinking this literally only this morning, I woke up of all things, I don't know why. But economics is the study of applied psychology. It really is. And yeah. investing yeah. is the study of applied psychology plus a little bit of evaluation maths that you could probably do in year eight. Mm. And that's kind of it, right? And so it's a nice way to think about it, because for all of the fact that the RBA has moved away from something ending in 0.25, 0.5 or 0.75, they've still gone up in 0.25% or 0.5% numbers. And those in the market who were predicting something different assumed that the RBA might want to get back to something that resembled that. So the people said, I'll be 0.4. Why was it 0.4? Was it because they thought 0.4% was the right number? No, because it got us back to 0.75, which again, that feels comfortable because then rounds up the way we used to it. And you think, hang on, so central bankers, the boffins, the people who have all of the decimal points at their disposal say, let's do it in 0.5% or 0.25% jumps. And the economists who were predicting it were like, oh, I think they're going to go to 0.75 because that's a nice... And you kind of think, you know... There's no point. False precision is what it is. Well, I was going to say, we talk a lot about that idea of being roughly right rather than precisely wrong, and I think that's kind of it. Does it matter that it's 0.4 or 0.5? Not really, because it's more than it was, and when it gets to 2 point something, it'll be 2 point something. Whether it's 2.16 or 2.29, it won't really matter. The point is the quantum, the rough quantum is what we're talking about here, and the RBA is going to get there. But I just thought it was interesting from both sides, both groups, still, despite all of that stuff, end up in that kind of rough, kind of just comfortable fractions. By the way, it also goes back, and this is the other thing, we've been using decimal currency since 1966. For those people who don't believe, we did have had something before the Australian dollar. We had Australian pounds, shillings and pence. And we kind of, and the US.
But back when you were in your 20s, is that when that happened?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, thank you. we've had that for the years. I don't know if Australian shares were ever quoted in fractions. US shares were for a while, yeah. And we're still talking in fourths of a percentage point. And it's just a really, really funny thing. It's not good or bad. It doesn't really matter. But it's just funny that those what's the right word? The things that we used to, the kind of the
labeling
fall back on. Yeah. It's generations of central bankers have just grown up with the idea that back when we didn't have decimals and we didn't have calculators, quarters were just easier. It was less than one, and it was small enough to be meaningful, large enough to be discussable. So let's make it quarters. And we just have never changed because we never changed. And we don't need to. But it's just interesting that for all of the new thinking and everything else, that applied psychology thing, it's just become tradition. And so that's what they do. And like I said, neither good nor bad, just interesting.
You know what? That is actually a pretty profound point you make, I think, because it extends to...
I quote you on that. Andrew said, so made a profound point.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things in our modern world where they're that way because they've always been that way and that's how they are. And it's just like, sometimes it's worth sort of applying a first principles approach to things. And you go, that doesn't make any sense.
If we design this, right, yes.
Yeah. And the answer is, oh, we've always done it that way. And it's like, well, and then the answer to that is, well, if you take the last 50 years as having been always, then yes, but not before that. Like it's really interesting how we, I think it's our nature that we adapt and we get used to things, and then we just kind of treat that as some natural consequence of the universe and it must always be so. I think that's, let's not get into the craziness of Elon Musk, but I think people him have a bit of cut through in a lot of things because they're the kind of, or the Steve Jobs to pick another example, or pick your favorite entrepreneur. They just got to go, actually, it doesn't need to be that way, and let's do it differently. So a bit of a side point, but I'll come back to interest rates. A couple things I want to make mention of here. Okay. Firstly, isn't it interesting that, because I was watching the night before the news, and Alan Kohler was sort of there saying, we've done the survey of economists. We surveyed 22 of the world's, of Australia's smartest economists, and I think three of them out of 22 called for a 0.5% increase. Now this isn't me just having poking fun at the economists. They give an answer because they're asked. It's actually poking fun at us because we keep asking. They keep getting it wrong.
And we keep asking.
I mean, he's like, When do we learn that lesson? And it's more, what's the interesting thing is not what figure that, I mean, okay, give us your best guess, that kind of thing. I actually saw some back patting on Twitter saying, congratulations to the guys at blah, blah, blah who predicted it correctly. I was like, oh, God's sake, it's like they got lucky and when they've gotten 12 in a row correct, and then I'll join in the celebrations, So I think that kind of thing drives me a little bit crazy. The other point I wanted to make is I think there's been a lot of criticism. We've been critical, I think, of the RBA. I'm not going harder and sooner on all of that. And so I think there's a lot of there was a lot of sort of criticism of the RBA of that in the past. So I actually feel as though a big move was warranted. I actually congratulate them on that.
Yeah.
And all mortgage holders are getting very angry at me right now, but I'm going to stand by that statement.
Not like you. It's your natural place.
I did tweet out saying that higher interest rates are good for savers, which was
interesting
responses. It's true. Fact, right? Like we
it's
all
Andrew
talk
Page,
about
PAGE.
I'm not, and like, I've got cash savings.
I'm happy. If you want the grief, mate, I'm happy for you to get it. I'm just making sure I don't get it. That's all. If you want to stick your neck out on this one, I think go. No, I'm kidding.
I think the kook made the point as well. He said one third of people have, two thirds of people don't have a mortgage.
Correct.
Right. So, but when you, if you were to watch or read the media, it's like, oh my gosh, we're all in dire straits because we've all had to pay 0.5% extra on our mortgage. Like, well, actually, for 2/3 of people, no, it's more nuanced than that. I get it. It will flow through to rent. I get it. But then you can say, well, of the third of people who have a mortgage, the people who are right at the edge are a smaller percentage of that as well. So it's kind of, again, context, nuance. We're not, as a species, big on that. But I think it's important. Really, I think it's really important to sort of highlight that.
Yeah.
And the final thing I wanted to say is I am not, we've said this before, I am not envious of the central bankers. Can you imagine, you've got this big lever, you're driving this highly complex dynamic system. there is no economy, right? Let's be clear. There is no economy. All there is is a bunch of human beings interacting with one another.
Yeah.
Using these earth dollars that we sort of, you know, these little tokens that we interact with. And it's like, so you have to sit on top of in this big tower, understanding how literally tens of millions of people are interacting. And by the way, you only get to look through the rear vision mirror. So you don't even know what people are doing now. You know what they did in the last quarter or most reason. And then you've got, it's not like there's this big control panel in front of you with 1,000 knobs and levers and buttons. It's like there's one and you get to tweak that. It's sort of like, it blows my mind that we put so much emphasis on the ability and the power of these people. Like, how do you do it? And I'm not having a go at them. I think you could get the smartest economist in the world and put all the resources at their disposal, and they are going to get it wrong on a regular basis. Not because they're idiots, but because what we're asking them to do is diabolically hard. I wish that the media put as much emphasis on fiscal policy as they did on monetary policy.
Can I tell you? But economists are the same, mate. Like, the blow up on Twitter, just so regularly about the RBA did or didn't do with a quarter of a point here or there, or 25 basis points, as you like to say. I honestly, that to me, I'm going to, you know, like outlandish statements. I think it's very close to just, I don't know, I don't want to say dereliction of duty, but the journos and the economists and everybody else, we talk about it. You know why we talk about it? Because it happens. A thing happened. And so we talk about it, right? And you and I do exactly the same thing. We try and put it in context, and we try and keep it in context, as you're mentioning right now, which is super important, right? 12 times a year, 11 times a year, they don't meet in January, I think. 11 times a year, the RBA makes a rates call. And we go, oh, okay. Once a year, the government hands down a budget. We go, okay, cool, that's done. Like, as you say.
It's really out of whack, isn't it?
I've used the analogy before. You know, the RBA is flying a biplane with a joystick. Goes up, down, or flat. That's all you can do. It's all they can do, right? Can't even turn. It goes up, down, and flat. Yeah. The government are flying a fleet of FA-18 Hornets. I'm giving up my military knowledge here, with heads-up displays and sophisticated computers, and they call back to base and everything else. You know,
4,000 buttons. Yeah,
right. And dials and switches and levers and self-leveling technologies and everything else. And we go, bloody RBA, they've cooked it again. It's like, hang on, while I'm on the rant, sorry, mate, I've taken over your point.
No, go. I agree.
I love an independent central bank. I think it's really, really smart, right? I think, frankly, politicians don't deserve any more power than they already have. But the problem is, and we've said this before too, I'm pretty sure, because politicians are, again, I was going to make random, I'll be kinder, electorally focused. Let's call it that way. Use that euphemism. Because they're electorally focused, and frankly, they think in, you know, 24-hour news cycles, let alone 3-year bloody terms. The RBA is left to be the adult in the room. So not only does it only have one button or one lever, but it gets to do that kind of they look over the wall from Martin Place to Canberra. It's not literally a wall, it's a long way, but you know, and they go, they've done, Christ. All right, well, I guess we've got to put rates up then. Or I guess we've got to put rates down then. Because those knuckleheads in Canberra can't tie their own shoelaces, let alone run the economy. And it's, you know, yeah. I don't want the two combined again. But I have to say, if all of a sudden the treasurer of the day, be it Josh Frydenberg or Jim Chalmers, was responsible for rate and tax policy and everything else, I do wonder whether they wouldn't say, oh, I can't put rates up. I might go and actually do this thing over here on tax or spending or something else, you know? And that's, we, as you say, we talk about rates.
It's far more, but you can direct it far more. It's far more tight. It's just, you've got a lot more. It's
so much more efficient, mate. Yeah. So much more efficient. So, anyway, I interrupted your rant about your rant.
No, it was exactly the rant I was going to have. I would almost, I've got to tread very carefully here, but I would almost say that.
Not like you.
Here's kind of an irony because we are unabashedly, unashamedly a capitalist system.
Yes.
And there's huge advantages with that.
Yes.
It kind of blows my mind that at the heart of our capitalist system, we've got centrally planned banking apparatus. You know, it's kind of like, that's kind of, if you think again, first principles, it's sort of like an unelected bureaucrat making these huge calls, massively influential.
Yeah.
And it's like, what about the free market? You know, so it's a little bit odd. And the other thing I would prompt people to think about here is that I would make a deeper statement when it comes to if you want to think about interest rates, look not so much at the central banks, look at the bond market, because this is where it does sort of tilt back into a more market-oriented system, which is, I would say, and I think most economists would probably agree with me, is that ultimately it's the bond market that sets interest rates. And that is an interaction between willing participants of people who want to raise money and those who want to lend it out. And it's just done in a market environment. So the RBA can do what it likes to some extent. But if the bond market is saying, well, actually, we're not, if buyers in the bond market are not prepared to buy any debt for less than 5%, you know, and let's not forget too, in Australia in particular, I'm not exactly sure how it is in various other economies in the world, but you'll remind me of this. But I feel as though it's like a third of the money that we have in our system is borrowed from overseas bond markets.
That's why roughly, I think it might be a little bit larger, but it's in that sort of range,
That's a lot. That is a lot, right?
Yes, so that's a good word.
So people shaking their fist at the RBA right now. Let's do a thought experiment. The RBA goes, no, we're just going to keep it at 0.15. Sorry, 0.35%.
Yeah.
We're going to keep it there forever. Your mortgage is still going up. Your mortgage is still going up because NAB, Westpac, ANZ, and the rest of them. A lot of their funding comes from over, and the funding that they are accessing is getting more expensive.
Correct.
So, you know, it's you've
and the same on the other side, by the way, when the US rates fall, that their funding goes down too. And I think the fiction that banks have to respond when and only when the RBA moves, I think is clear fiction, obviously. So, I think your point is very well made.
Can I go one more turtle down?
Go for it.
Which is. So we talk about the RBA as having this big lever. Well, actually, they do have another little knob, and that is where they engage in market. What are they called? What's the word for it? Direct market operation. Interaction. Market operation. Thank you.
Open market.
So what they can do.
Open.
Thank you. That's the one. That's the term I'm looking for. Open market operations, and this is where they will actually engage in the bond market. So the Australian government might say, oh, we want to raise some money because we're running a structural deficit, so we need some extra cash. Yeah. So here's a bond. Let's call it a spade, an IOU. It's an IOU. It's all it is with a set of fixed interest payments or coupon payments, as they're called, attached to that.
Yes.
And they'll usually go to the market, investment banks, even mum and dads, you know, anyone who go, this is how it used to be done in the old days, right? Yes. And then we would give our money to the government back in the day. And and this is how wars were funded. This is how you go right back, and this is how governments got their money through tax and through lending, right?
Yeah.
And so But what the other ability that the RBA has is that if there is not enough demand, or if the demand isn't as sufficient as they would like, or whatever, they can just come in and say, "Well, actually, we'll buy them for you."
Yeah,
and they don't just go down into the vault. They just press a button and they go, poof, you know, in magic money into existence. Now that money disappears again when the trade goes the other way. So there's a lot of memes out there. You know, money printer goes burr and all of this kind of stuff. It's not as crazy as some extremists make out, but it is nevertheless fascinating that is also something that they can do. So I've just sort of said, well, the RBA doesn't really influence interest rates too much. It's the bond market. Mm. But then I've kind of said, yeah, but then the RBA and other central banks, the Fed in the US, which is the central bank of central banks, you know, it's the central bank of the world.
Yep.
It actually gets in there and says, we'll start buying bonds. So it's kind of like, it's very circular and it's very interesting. And the amount of money in the system with, I think it's the US, Australia's the same actually with COVID and whatever, but I think something like of all of the US dollars in existence, there's like 30 to 35% more than there was a couple of years ago. Wow. And that's because of these open market operations. It's fascinating. And I'm not saying therefore, you know, we're all going back to the Stone Age, but I'm just, it's a fact and it's noteworthy and it's interesting. Is all I'm saying.
I like it. I am.
I told you I was gonna skirt along some.
Well, I'm just. I guess I'm curious to see the next step, which is the so what.
Well, I think for a while there wasn't a so what.
Is it just a reminder that things are complex?
Well, I don't know. So for a long time there wasn't a so what because all of that money that was created didn't end up on Main Street. It ended up on Wall Street. So in other words, and that we saw that in market valuations. What's different now, I think, well, there's a war in Europe, so that's a very big factor. Let's put that aside. But you had a lot of direct stimulus, and so a lot of the money that was created more recently actually went into the pockets of consumers. And what do consumers do with money? They spend it. In fact, that's the point. That's the raison d'être of giving the money to help stimulate.
It's also the reason for being.
And, yeah, exactly.
I was translating your French for you. Sorry, my car.
But again, let's go back. I find this stuff fascinating. But first principles. Now, whatever central banks and bond markets and all of this financial engineers do, there is no like the amount of stuff on planet Earth doesn't change. Right? The amount of people willing to provide services doesn't change.
Yeah.
So the amount of the tokens that we use to interact with each other changes.
Yep.
And this isn't me sort of being too fringe and crazy. This is what all of them. This is what it, when it first when the G. If you want to go back, and let's go back 13 years to the GFC, exactly when the RBA and the central bank started doing a lot of this stuff, all the economists are saying, "Okay, we get it. We have to do it because if we don't, the whole system collapses." But the price we will pay for this is inflation. The price we will pay is inflation, and it didn't happen. And then back to your earlier point, we just all get used to it. It's like, turns out we can create a heap of money and nothing happens. And it's like, but the chickens have come home to. I feel as though the chickens have come home to roost to some extent, where it's kind of like, okay, you can only inflate that balloon so much before some of the air starts to sort of dribble out. Your question is exactly the right one. So what? And I'm not going to pretend for a second I've got an answer because I don't. But I feel as though it's not nothing, right? It's not like, oh, well, it's cool. It's like, well, is it? I don't know. Last time, again, a lot of parallels being drawn in the 70s, man. We got 15% inflation on the CPI at one point there, right? And no coincidence, the market dropped 40% over a multi-year period. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're seeing it play out to some extent. So again, this is sounding all very conspiratorial, very sort of doom and gloom. I'm honestly, hand on heart, not trying to go there, but I am trying to say is it's noteworthy and it feels important. And I've got no answers to offer. What are your thoughts on all of that?
So we were going to talk about inflation a bit. So let's roll into that because it's a perfect way to make this transition. So the thing about the 70s is, and this is where, hopefully, I think the Great Recession, as the Yanks call it, the GFC as we call it, was less severe than it could have been. And frankly, COVID was much, much better than it could have been economically because we learned lessons from the Great Depression.
Yep.
And that's where, if you're looking at the Reserve Bank today, I am broadly in favor of them raising rates to try and kill inflation off, right? Because if we let inflation, I'm coming back to your question. If we let inflation go at 8% for 3 years, don't forget it's compounded, not simple interest, right? So if you compound 8% for 3 years, what's that, 27, 28%, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So everything, the average household grocery bill, the average household power price, now, not everything's going to be exactly that amount, but, you know, across the board, everything goes up 30%. Now, if, as a wage earner, you're not getting a wage rise, you're going to find 30% savings. Now, maybe you've got some savings, maybe you can stop investing for a bit. The rest has got to come from, I'm going to spend less money on a thing. I'm going to buy fewer things, right? And that's a massive and material reduction. Massive and material, by definition, is the same thing. It can't be material if it's not massive, or vice versa. We will buy less stuff. And so rates going up, even though it's, you know, yes, we're solving higher prices by putting prices up, in this case on mortgages, and as you say, for only a third of the population, but still real and economically impactful. The point I want to make is the lesson from the 70s. And by the way, the other thing about the 70s, for those who weren't around, you and I were, but only just, is...
The 70s did produce the greatest generation of all time.
It did, clearly.
Make that comment. Yeah.
For all you millennials and boomers out there, the Generation X does actually exist. If you could stop fighting amongst yourselves and recognize we are here and we matter, that would be nice too, by the way. yes. It's what we know, so back to history, right? We had a supply... Sorry, actually, let me go back to inflation for a second. The argument for some is, don't put rates up because it's supply push inflation. It is oil prices going through the roof. It is wheat shortage from Russia. Wheat shortages, Russia. Supply chain dramas because of COVID. These things aren't being created by people going nuts with their spending. Which, so when
it's
we talk
not
about
a demand-induced problem. And I'm not going to interrupt you for long, but just...
No, go for it.
It's not only that supply side thing, but there's supply side things that you would call inelastic if you're an economist. If you're a normal person, you'd say, well, they're things you just can't live without. So right, it's like, exactly. You know, I can pull back on my flat screen TV consumption. I can't easily pull back on my fuel or my bread consumption. Those other things are a bit different.
I can't drive halfway to work. It's not going to work.
Right.
You've got to go all the way to work, right? So,
I'm not going to cut back on food too much. Yeah.
Right. Well, some people will have to, right? You'll downgrade and, you know, maybe mince rather than rump steak or scotch fillet or whatever. But yeah, that's, you know, but overall, sure. You're right. It's reasonably inelastic. So some people will say, and with very reasonable perspectives, hey, we're putting up rates, we're making things harder for people, and it's not going to have the impact you want because we can't reduce consumption of those inelastic goods. So we're just making it harder for people with no real promise of a solution. And I absolutely 100% get that. I think they have a very real perspective. History would tell us, and back to your point about the 70s, at the end of the 70s, they had to kill inflation with a stick by jacking rates up a long way, causing meaningful financial pain. I won't say they had to. There may have been other options, but this is the one they chose. So it worked, or we know it worked. It's a very real, very problematic, but very real solution in the past, at least. Paul Volcker, head of the US Fed back in the very late 70s, early 80s, jack rates up to kill inflation dead because he had to. And that was supply push inflation. It was largely an oil shock. There were a series of oil shocks. OPEC, God love them, formed a cartel for oil and said, hey, guess what? The price of oil is going up. You suckers can pay that. If you don't like it, I don't care. And we all did. Inflation went through the roof. And it's not the same cause this time, but same commodity, as it turns out. To your point about Echo's RAM, 50 years later or 45 years later. So that's where we find ourselves. And yes, we won't be slowing down excess demand with interest rates like we would in most other times when this is a problem. But if there is an echo of the 70s, to my mind, it is the fact that it's oil-induced. It's probably going to be high and persistent. And we know they killed it last time by jacking up rates. Now, maybe it could have been other options. And those people who are saying they shouldn't do it this time would probably say they could have done something different last time. And maybe they could. But we know from history this sort of thing works. And if we do it well and properly, it should be achievable even with some economic pain. And again, I'm not saying that because it doesn't matter. I say that because the alternative is 30, 35, 40, 45% higher prices, higher household bills. We say prices, as you say, mate, there's no economy, there's no price either. There's only the total number of bills we have to pay and the total value of those. If those bills go up by 30, 35, 40% over 4 or 5 years, man, like, you know, adding interest rate pain to that is not going to make life feel any better. But if we can restrict that to 15, 17, 20% rather than 40%, if everything is 20% less expensive because of this, it's a price worth paying, particularly in the short to medium term, to make sure we don't have this runaway inflation problem. And that's what they're worried about. So I have a lot of sympathy for people who say, It's not going to change demand. It's absolutely not. But it will change aggregate demand. So, yes, you can't use less oil necessarily, although some people catch the train. Some won't go on a driving holiday. Some will do different things, and that's completely appropriate. Unfortunately, as with all these things, it hits people on low incomes and fixed incomes harder, and that sucks because people who are saving a lot of money or who are already rich, you know, maybe their assets fall in value a little bit, but they don't care unless they're selling. It hurts people who have got to pay the bills and get to work, and you know, they normally live in outlying suburbs, so they've got more petrol to spend and all that kind of stuff. So it's all absolutely true. But I just wanted to make the point that for all of that, hey, it's supply, and it absolutely is. We know that in the past, a version of one solution is rates up, kills inflation. It worked. I will say, unfortunately, it also caused a recession. And that's the bit that I think... you're talking about central banks when you started, mate. They have got, you know, for the last 10 years, we said, oh, the central banks are not earning their money, they're not doing anything. They meet, they say, let's not change anything, and they go home again. Of course, that's not all they did. It's a silly thing to say. But, you know, there was some laugh about that stuff. This time around, they've got to choose between two stupidly difficult and annoying and painful options. There is no joy in Martin Place right now. They're not saying, oh, thank God, we wanted to put rates up, or we're glad we can put rates up, or we'll put rates up, it won't hurt anybody. They're literally saying, this will suck. For individuals and for the economy as a whole, or for society as a whole, this will suck, but we don't have a good option. There are two bad choices, and we'll try and choose the least worst one. It's a tough place to be.
It is diabolically hard. It is diabolically hard. No easy answers. And again, I do feel for the less financially secure, because it is always at that end that cops it, you know.
Yeah. So the other thing, mate, and this goes to the why the RBA is doing something and why they're feeling the need to act so significantly. Glenn McFarlane, previous RBA governor, said this week he expects interest rates. Glenn Stevens and Ian McFarlane, not one person, believe it or not. Ian McFarlane, thank you, mate. Said that he expects inflation to go 8% this year.
Actually, I saw the headline, and you know, lo and behold, the headline was more sensationalistic than the actual thing.
Surely
if you dig
not.
Into what he said, I think they'll go higher. Could go 5, 6, 7, 8. And, you know, he said the phrasing was he wasn't saying it will go to 8, but he was it's going to go higher, and it could go up to that. He sort of bit of hand waviness. So just again, I don't want to. The headline exaggerates the subtlety of what he was saying. Yeah.
So he did. Well, here's why it's probable. We've said this before, but inflation for the first quarter of this calendar year was 2.1%. If that simply persists for the year, four quarters at 2% is 8% annual inflation. And like the math is literally that simple in this case. Now it might fall, the dollar might change, oil price might change. A lot of things could impact the inflation rate, right? So it's worth thinking about. You know, I'm not locking it in, but it doesn't even require heroic assumptions. Was going to be my point. It's not even like I've looked in my crystal ball and I think this is, you know, we're going to have these things going to change. So therefore, it must be the case that inflation will get to 5, 6, 7, 8. It's literally just a case of, hey, all that has to happen is the current trend continues, and I think that's honestly as simple as it is. So I just wanted to throw that out there, because I think it's very tempting to kind of think, oh, couldn't possibly. And, or, you know, 8%, no, it's not going to happen here. It literally, annualized from last quarter, is already there. Now, you don't just annualize a number, it doesn't work that way, but it doesn't take much, it doesn't take anything for inflation to get to that point. That's why the RBA feels so desperately need to do something, because they've looked at the first quarter number and gone, oh, bugger. This could get a lot worse and be more persistent, the other thing McFarlane said, before it goes away. And that's important as well.
Yeah, yeah. The other sort of unintended consequence of this is that when inflation and interest rates very much sort of tied at the hip. Mm-hmm. But what do you do in a system where inflation is whatever the numbers are?
Yeah, yeah.
If interest rates are lower than inflation,
yeah,
it basically says if it's dumb to hold cash. Right, like the only reason you hold cash is because I need it in the near term, and if I don't need to spend it in the next year or so, I need to find another home for it.
Yeah,
and the very act of finding a home for it will, by definition, increase sort of the demand for that whatever product, call it a property, call it shares, whatever, and that's going to sort of distort prices as well, which is a bit of a shame, I think, because you know there is a genuine and very rational need to have have something that you can save in. But when savers have been forced to become investors, that's a real sort of shame of where we find ourselves, I think, in the modern system, is that there's plenty of people out there who are looking at ETFs and looking at and I are the first to sort of say, hey, investing is really important. You need to invest.
Yep, 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 exactly.
But at the same time, you know, you would sort of say a modern economy is all about specialization. And if you happen to be a great dentist or a great chippy or whatever you are, it's sort of like you're also now required to be also a great investment analyst because you know, damned if you're going to leave money in cash for anything except the short term, because you're going back, whatever the interest rate is, you know, if inflation's higher than it, you're going backwards by definition in spending power. And that's, I think that's what we are as a society forcing ourselves further up the risk curve, and that's great for a lot of people, but for a lot of other people, it's not great, and it's kind of like it's gone to get to the point where it's like it's no longer really a choice that hey, I really want to start thinking about the longer term and making some certain small investments. Like I have to do it because otherwise I'm going backwards, and yeah, I don't know. I don't know what my point is, other than it's just sort of, it feels as though that is not a good thing.
Can you, I'm trying to think this through desperately as you're chatting, mate. I guess there's a couple of points. I think you're absolutely right in terms of inflation. That being said, they've been trying to push up the risk curve forever because that was one of lowering rates in the first place. Yeah. So it's not a new problem. The inflation rate spiking is a new problem, and the interest rate's trying to catch up with it. But even when the interest rate was at 0.1%, it was also the case, right? I don't remember. I'm trying to think about, and I'm trying to go back in my head to a time when savings rates were sustainably higher than inflation. I'm not entirely sure at an official cash rate basis, because none of us get paid that or have to pay that. We all pay a margin or version of that. We get it in the bank. But I'm trying to work out whether there was ever a time, other than the spiky, unusual ups or downs, but through, you know, 90% of the data is not at those extremes. I'm trying to remember whether there was a time when it was different. I'm trying to think through. Actually, I've just pulled up some numbers now. The real cash rate was positive until 2008 or so, and then again between 9 and about 15, and there's been just slightly negative ever since. So maybe that's your point.
Not for a while.
To your point, it's a really tricky one. I actually had this conversation on Twitter with somebody during the week, just talking about, you know, what savers should be, how an economy should be structured, how much savers should get for government guaranteed cash in the bank, and what rights we think they should have. Because I said, you know, I really haven't got a thought, but my thought was just like, I'm not sure whether a society and economy, I think economies have and societies have lots of obligations for their citizens, right? I'm not sure whether it's appropriate to have an expectation on savings in the bank beating inflation. We don't want to go backwards, but I'm also not entirely sure whether economically, I usually have a view on most things, but I'm trying to think through, why is it that we should say if you put money in the bank, you will get money that beats inflation? Like, why is that? Why would that be?
I'll give you a reason.
Could do or should do? Do we want to do it? I don't know.
I think we do. Okay. So within society, there'll be people who have excess savings, and there'll be other people who need access to capital because they've got a great business idea.
Yes.
They want to create more value in the world.
Yes.
They want to provide a service to other people. They want to invest in capital goods that will make them more efficient at doing that. At the end of the day, you know, we need to either be making more stuff, providing more service, increasing our general wealth as a society. So it's kind of like what the idea would be is just like, well, I will lend money to someone and I will do that under the expectation that they will take that money, they will build a business, they'll do something, and then more money will come back. And that needs to be greater than inflation. Otherwise, what the hell? Why am I taking the risk for if it's not? Now, back in the day, that was one of the core functions of a bank. And so I was just like, I just want to save it, right? And so, in fact, you know, put my gold shillings shekels with you. You will take that. In fact, I'll actually pay you to look after it. You're a custodial service for me, and I just don't want to walk around with my gold because that's really, really dangerous. And the bank would say, "Yep, cool. We'll look after it for you." And other people go to the bank saying, "Hey, we need it." And so then the bank would make this calculus. This is one of their core skills. Would sort of say, "Okay, we appraise you as a sensible person with a good plan. We will give that to you, and you will give us more back because you're creating actual more value in the real world. And then we will take a cut, and then we will pay back the depositor that did that. Now you've got maturity matching, and it gets a little bit more complicated than that. And there's fractional reserve banking. These rabbit holes are very deep. But if at a point that doesn't summate to something where I'm getting a positive real return, what the heck am I doing? I'm not going to lend it out at all. I'd rather just cop the regular deflation of my spending power, and not take any risk. Rather than this is the thing with that kind of environment, I have the exact opposite what any sane investor wants. Mm. I've got limited upside because I'm just getting a notional interest rate from the bank, but potentially I could lose the lot if the money that they've lent out is going to go to zero. That is backwards thinking. So I think structurally, fundamentally, you need to have that to encourage people who do have money to lend to the people who don't have money.
But what's the alternative though, Matt? Like, I think I hear all that, except I'm also now thinking, well, hang on, the first 250 grand is government guaranteed, so there's zero risk unless the government goes broke, so there's that. So I'm literally putting money risk-free, to your point, into a custodial service to access as I want. I'm not arguing against it. I'm not saying it shouldn't. The people shouldn't get a decent return. I'm just thinking about, you know, would we try and change, manipulate an economy, a banking system, or whatever, to have interest that is always or mostly or normally or whatever ahead of inflation? I mean, to actually do that would require certain things to happen, right? I'm just not sure how that plays out.
Yeah, you're right. But I think the trouble all of us make, and it's just the world that we've lived in recently, is that we assume that someone should be making these sort of decisions and guiding it. I would actually
That's what
say
I'm saying, but you're arguing the free that market should. But you're saying it should happen. I guess I'm saying it should suggest that there was someone who would act for that purpose rather than, you know, like that's otherwise the point is moot, right? Like why is there a should at all? It's like it is what it is. Who cares?
I think just people acting in their own rational self-interest at a granular level will sort of see that emergent property of the system, if that was to happen. So I mean, let's just say you and I and 100 people live on an island, and we've got our little economy, and I've got so many seashells, and you want some seashells because you want to open up a coconut stand. I mean, I'm just not going to give it to you if I think you're totally useless and that there's already 400 other coconut stands are in the islands. Like, it seems like a really dumb investment idea. I'm not going to give it to you. Not because I'm making any grand macroeconomic forecasts or anything. I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah.
If on the other hand, you're saying, actually, I've got this great, I'm an awesome fisher, and I catch lots of fish and no one else is catching fish, and every time I catch, and it's like, I will give you a lot of my seashells, happily. I will happily do that. And then you'll say thank you, because now I can build more rods and I can hire more people and I can get, and it's kind of, I think a lot of the time we need to get out of the way, frankly, and just let people make rational, interested decisions and make sure that there are rewards for the good decisions and penalties, frankly, for the wrong decisions. Mm. And it'll be a mess. And I promise you, I'm not going towards a big libertarian. I think there's a very, very important role for government and all the rest of it and public spending. But for a lot of things within our society, where we are talking about sort of discretionary kind of stuff, I think it's actually a really wonderful system. And I think that's been distorted to a point now where it's kind of like we're all going further and further and further up the risk. It's just a lot of financial engineering where nothing's actually being produced by any of this. As a society, we're not making necessarily more real value in all of that. And we're all getting lower and lower returns, and we're all just pumping more and more stuff into this. It feels... I don't know what it feels. Something's got to give at some point. And I don't know what that is.
That's right. I guess I make the point that if the market's going to sort that out, then it's not, you know, the issue is not really something needs to be done with, or is just a prediction of what might change or how things will change in future. Because to your point, if there's not worth putting money in the bank, people won't. If they decide it's not worth doing, then it's not about the saver or the spender. It's simply about the workings of the market, right? I guess I'm just trying to think through. You highlight the right problem or risk. I'm not sure there's a so what for policymakers or the economy in that context. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. This is what's so fascinating, and for something that we were going to start spending 15 minutes to talk on, we're now 45 minutes in. But it gets really deep. I mean, it's a very big question. And I don't. Anyone who's got a definite answer is probably wrong, because I don't think there is a definite answer to it all.
Yeah.
But there needs to be more of a discussion. These are big system-wide structural kind of questions, and they're really important. And again, to your very, very earlier point about how sort of we just accept things the way that they are, I'll make the point again. I mean, our current financial system is 50 years old. It's really young in terms of the full sort of fiat. So the idea of a central bank, you only have to go back to the 20s, but in that 1920s.
Yeah, 100 years old.
It's a really new phenomenon. It's like four generations. So I'm not saying, oh, therefore it's bad, but it is something sometimes often work thinking about things through first principles and saying, it's just a very recent experiment. What could go wrong? How do we fix it? What do we want? You kind of need to approach it like an engineer, not like a politician. And I don't know what the answer is. You know what you think? You think I'm going to go in a certain direction. I'm not in purpose, but yeah, it's endlessly fascinating.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Let's talk about banks for a minute. Because...
How is that a different topic?
I know. Well, it's the so what, right? You and I were chatting before the show. And the challenge that we're going to have... Well, so as we go through this and look back on this, there will be consequences for actions taken and not taken from the GFC through to 2024. Mm. And when we look back on that in 2026 and say, man, look at what just happened there. It'll be some version of, oh, how do we get out of that, through to, oh my God, that was a terrible recession, and probably somewhere in between. And we'll look back and go, right. And I think the challenge I've got, we're going to talk about energy, we're not going to have time, but when it comes to the current shortage of energy and that kind of stuff, without getting political or even necessarily in a policy, we could have made different decisions in terms of the framework for the energy system 5, 10, 15 years ago. Storage of oil and gas is a starting point, right? Or the redundancy of the system. And we won't go into necessarily what we should do in that case. But, you know, there was a time to say, hey, what if in 2022 we had some coal offline, a cold snap, gas got expensive, you know, how would we choose to design a system that was resilient? And I think it's reasonable to say, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, feel free to comment on it, but, you know, I think it's fair to say we stuffed it. Like, politicians across the board, bureaucrats, whatever, we got to a point, we had a crisis, like, we really should have planned better for this. So now I think about the economy and I think about 2026 and we go, all right, we're already in this situation, so we've missed the opportunity to set up before 2022. But between now and whenever we look back, we have the opportunity to make some changes to some things. And we don't know what those things will be. We all have speculations and assumptions, and they're probably wrong because no one predicted COVID. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen next? The war in Ukraine was one of those X factors that, you know, maybe you could have predicted for 50 years and eventually been right, but it was pretty useless for the first 49 years of that prediction. The banks are in a really funny position. I don't mean funny. I mean funny, strange. And we're talking about this off air, but the idea that we might, in hindsight, look back and say, hey, too much money was lent to people with too little planning or risk mitigation or whatever we want to call that. Now, maybe we don't buy it. That's the other problem, is we can only look and think what we might see. Some of that stuff, by definition, you know, black swans are black swans because they're black swans, not because you predict them. That's part of the problem. But banks are in a funny situation, mate. As entities, they are responsible for the vast bulk of Australian residential and business lending. As entities, they are responsible for meaningful amounts of wealth creation and the custodianship, as we just talked about before. I'm liking that word. I'm going to use it a lot. Of our savings. They are so fundamental, and they are truly, in systemic terms, too big to fail, in the sense that we can't let a bank failure resonate through the economy, or it would, you know, cause untold and long-lasting damage. Whether the organisation should be allowed to fail is a different question. But as connectors of fund flows, if I can try and describe it somehow, that connection can't be allowed to break, or it would literally throw the whole thing into massive chaos. What is the role of the banks? What is the responsibility of the banks versus the regulators, versus other players, including the RBA and the market politicians? I think it's, I mean, we can't answer it because we don't know what's going to happen. But if you look forward, mate, and say, we are where we are, now what? What's on your mind in terms of how we might do things differently to maybe minimize some of the systemic risks and take out some of the excesses of the system?
Yeah, I've just sort of railed a little bit about how we need more freedom in certain markets, but now I'm going to say
it's important to be able to talk about both sides of our mouths. That's what we do.
I just think you can't have such, when, if you're making t-shirts or kitchen appliances, you know, that's one thing. When your business is fundamentally critical to the operating of our society, that it's a huge responsibility, right?
Yeah.
So I'm all for the profit motive. I'm all for them banks making money. They need to. We need to give the proper incentives at play. But I think with such power comes great responsibility, to quote Spider-Man.
That's important.
Uncle
JP Morgan,
whatever.
I'm pretty sure it's JP Morgan.
Yeah, that's right. And I would have very, very stringent regulations on what they're able to do.
Yeah,
you know, they are very profitable entities, and I think that they will kick and scream, "Oh, you can't do that because we won't make it." I'm like, well, I'll call that bluff any day. Any day, I will call that bluff.
Yeah. Right.
It just has to be that way. So what do you do there? You probably lift the capital adequacy ratios, so the amount of money that they need to keep in reserve, so there's bigger buffers, probably tighter lending conditions, all kinds of things that they're not going to be happy about. But you kind of need to, because there's this thing called moral hazard. If we weren't so stupid as a species, we may have learned that lesson in 2008. Yeah. Because if I'm a CEO of a major bank, and I'm looking at my lending book and I'm thinking, oh, geez, it looks a bit shaky, I'm still going to keep dancing as long as the music's playing. As long as the punch bowl's out, I'm drinking from it. Because if I don't, because even though things could look precarious, they could still go on for another 5-10 years, you know? Mm. And if I'm the person, it's a game theoretical dilemma. If I'm the person who goes, no, this is crazy, I'm pulling back, all I do is lose market share, lose profitability, my shareholders get very angry, and I get kicked out, and I get replaced by some person who's going to do it anyway. So I do it, right? I do it because I have to do it. And here's the thing. Let's say I do it and it does go all pear-shaped the next day. I don't care. I mean, I might care on a certain level, but I'm still getting my pay. I'm probably, and this is the other thing from the GFC, I'm probably still getting my bonus, or at least a big chunk of it. So it's kind of like worst. Okay, upside is we all continue to party like it's 1999 and we all make squillions and it's great. Worst case scenario is, and this is the worst case scenario is, I lose my job and I only make $48 million this year instead of 62. Like, that is an asymmetry that is, you know, I kind of think you can't have it both ways. You can't have capitalism for the upside and socialism for the downside. It's just not. It's either brutal capitalism, in which case we say, well, too bad, you're not too big to fail, we're going to let you fail. And then, as you pointed out pre-recording, it's like that actually has a whole bunch of really bad consequences for people who have no fault of their own. So it's like, okay, well, then you go full the other way. And it's like when you come to these massive government-regulated industry, and that's got all kinds of problems. So it's sort of, the answer is so often the case, lies somewhere in between, which I would say continue to let them do what they do, but with much, 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 much tighter regulations. And if they don't like it, we'll let in another bank who will be more than happy to do it, because there's still economic rents to be extracted.
Well, I mean, the economic rents thing is right. It comes down to the rate of return needed, required, justified by the investment. And someone will pay a price for access to that money. I'm reminded of Warren Buffett's line about tax, something along the lines, trying to get it right. He says something like, words to the effect of, maybe you'll find someone who won't proceed with a great investment idea because of the tax he'll have to pay if it succeeds.
Yes.
If that's the case, send him my way. Let me unburden him. Which I love as a line, right? And so the line basically there was, hey, if you're going to, you know, avoid making $100 because you're going to pay $50 in tax, then I'll take the extra $50 profit, thanks very much. And then going to your point
of
on banks.
Of course.
Right. And your point on banks is like, well, if you can't make a 20% return, you make a 15% return, you reckon no one's going to come and take that money? Of course they are. You know, they might
like kick 20, and scream.
Right,
they'll pay the lobbyists. You know, it's like, it's going to be the end of the world. It's like, So this is a bit tangential, but kind of related. Mm-hmm. There was a, I don't know if you saw it, on Twitter there was a round of the Norwegian energy minister recently, because we're obviously having a gas shortage and there's a whole lot of discussion to be had there. But he's making the same point. He's just like, well, actually, we own the gas. And we said that foreign companies can come in. But you know what they tax them at? They tax them at 78%. 7.8. Not 7.8, 78%. And you know what? They came. They came because there was money to be made. As much money as you would make in some parts of the world where there's no tax. Obviously not. You know, they would make much more in places like Australia, dare I say, where we don't seem to have the same kind of vision. and the Norwegians were just genius, right? They said, so they called the bluff. Energy companies came in. They made $1 squillion for the people of Norway, and Norway put together a really awesome portfolio that will fund that nation for generations well after we have transitioned away from oil and gas. What vision, what leadership, what, you know, I just think we should be doing the same. Not because I'm a communist, but because I think that it's we who own this stuff, and if we want it to be attractive enough for others to come in and do the work.
Yep.
Because otherwise, why would they? So we make a return. This is how the system works. Absolutely, I want a big fossil fuel company to come in and make some money, because if they don't, well, it just stays underground and we never get it. And no one's better off, right? Mm-hmm. But if they're gonna do it, just do it at just enough to get you interested, and we'll keep the rest, right? Like if it was in your back, in your backyard, that's what you would do as a household.
Sure would.
If you and your lovely wife discovered 100,000 barrels of oil equivalent in your backyard, you're not going to say, "Come in, but I'm going to make you extract as much
whatever
value
the market
from
price
that
is, knock yourself out, and give me a
you're
couple
gonna say,
when you go through." Yeah, exactly.
You were going to say, "Well, it's mine." No, I'm not going to dig it. So I need to make it worth your while, but I'm extracting the majority of this value because it's mine. And then I don't want to do it. Like, well, someone else will, dude. Someone else will.
It's funny. I mean, you're exactly right. Imagine, we talk about it's below the ground. Imagine it's above the ground. Imagine Australian property was like, oh, you can have anything you want for $5 a square meter. You mean I can have the CBD of Sydney? Yeah, it's all the same. But someone else might pay me more. I don't care. Just take it. Yep. But it's
insanity.
Absolutely. And I the other thing that drives me nuts, oh man, massive tangent. They do it as a percentage of the sale price for most royalties, which is blatant stupidity, because it means that when the price is low, the government gets less money, but we still sell as much because it's in no one's interest not to sell it. If you can get it out of the ground and sell it, if you're a miner, right, and you can drill at $20 a barrel and sell it for $40, you got to keep doing it because, well, at least it's something. At least I'm making some money. There's plenty down there. And if I don't do anything this year, then the shareholders are going to sell me, I'm sacked, right? If it goes to $100 a barrel, well, then I'm going to do the same amount because I'm already getting as much as I can. The government makes more, sure. If you knew you could sell it in a year's time, 2 years time, 3 years time, $100 a barrel, if it was $20, you'd be like, I'm not going to sell today. If you owned a house and the housing market crashes, you know, you go, I was going to sell anyway, so I'm going to keep selling even though the price is halved. So now I'm going to say, oh, no, I think I'll wait. I think I'll wait till prices recover. It is absolute madness. It would be simply resolved by saying, you know what? The royalty is $48 a barrel. If you can't sell it at profitability at that point, cool. Put a plug in the thing and then start. I know it's not that simple, by the way. And then start selling it again.
It's
when
not, the price far is off. Not far
well,
off. Not far off.
Iron ore is even easier, right? Put it in a pile. I'm going to charge you $50 a ton royalty. If you come at money, that's okay. Because when the price goes back up, someone will come and get it from me. So knock yourself out. There's just no need for. I own shares in Fortescue, for the record, and I would happily have that rule for the company I own shares in and every other iron ore company. It's just on a social level, the amount of value created and captured by the people who own the assets, right? They're ours, as you say, Ram. It's slightly nuts.
It feels like whenever I get into these conversations, and my wife can't take me anywhere, the poor thing. Some barbecue,
you know,
I'm going to rail against.
She's paying me to do this podcast just so you can get it out and not have to work on the weekend.
But I'm always like in the car on the way home. I was just sort of like, I always feel like, well, you know, why is this a controversial thing? I don't get it, you know, but we are so conditioned by, I don't know what it is, the media or whatever, people go, oh, but this and that. It's just like, no, I'm with you. I'm with you there. But there are more important things at play. And we just remember when they tried to introduce a resources rent tax and all these other kinds of really great initiatives, and it makes you feel as you belong to that side of politics. I'm like, no, but on a policy basis, I agreed with it. Right? Yeah. Like, can I not agree with a policy of a certain political party without being all in on everything that they say and ever do? It's like, it's stupid. And I just feel as though these aren't theoretical things that belong in the halls of economic academia. We've got real world test tubes from around the world where countries have done these things and they've worked out really, really well. Not for some foreign owned gas company, for the people who live there who now have to pay less tax because there's all this other money coming in, and who as a nation have much more infrastructure and services and we're richer. I'm for being richer. That's what I stand for. Right. And I don't know why that's a controversial thing. It's just like, if there's wealth to be had, then let's see who owns that wealth ultimately. We do, the people of the country.
Yeah.
And let's extract it for our maximum benefit in hard-nosed capitalistic fashion, because that's what I want. No, let's protect the environment and let's do some sensible long-term planning and all. I'm very, very big on all of that stuff too. But I'm I just don't know why it's so controversial to say that company that is owned by overseas people who don't pay any tax and extracting all that, just seems, it seems, I don't know why that's a political statement. It seems wrong. Rant's over. Talk myself back from the ledge.
No, you're right, mate. I can't disagree. It just makes logical sense. There is. I can't even think of a good reason why you wouldn't do it. I really, really can't. Right? Other than the status quo and a bit of ideology and politics and whatever else. If you've got a barrel of oil or a ton of iron ore, you can sell one time. Are you going to, as a country, say, well, I've got it now, and once it's sold, it's sold.
It's gone.
And let's make sure we sell it for the highest possible price, because that would be smart.
That's really smart.
Right? Rather than just saying, oh, it's there, let's just sell it. Who cares? So let's sell it now. Why now? Because the company will sell it. Right. Well, how much do we get for it? Oh, whatever they get for it.
Oh, jobs. We're going to create 1,000 jobs. Like, yeah, that's cool, but we could still do that. You know, it's just big picture, people. Madness. Big picture.
Madness, madness, madness. Mate, you've
Have we left any other problems in the world we haven't solved yet?
Oh, yeah. We'll do.
I feel
we'll
warmed up now.
World peace on Sunday, mate. Oh, that's what there I'm, we go. Back, can I tell you, I've got a couple of lists on my list of things here I really want to talk about, but we're going to have to hold them over, which is fine. Speaking of which, if you've made it this far, thank you, dear listener, for spending some time with us. A bit of more time. Not that, but it's only just over an hour, which is not bad for us these days, Ram.
Well, it's just over an hour, but when we started, it's like, oh, let's talk about these things. I think we got through the first two.
Exactly. So, but here's the thing. I am going away in a couple of weeks' time. I'm not going to be here. We're going to pre-record, hopefully, 3 weeks' worth of podcast if there's enough content to cover. And that's where you come in. Because we need to get your questions, comments, feedback, and suggestions. If there is stuff, so here's two things. If you have a question for the podcast, please throw it our way. We always want questions. We love your questions, and I need them in advance so we can stack them up. If we don't have enough questions, there won't be a podcast, and that would be sad for me. It'd be sad for Andrew. You may not notice, but if you do, it'd be sad for you. Also, too, though, if you have topics you want us to spend an episode on, you've only got about a few days to get this in because we'll start pre-recording next week. But please let us know if there are broad topics. Maybe we've done inflation and you know, banks and stuff.
Yeah, we've definitely done it, but
we've probably covered those. Yeah. But if there's kind of big investing or economic topics you want us to talk about, to delve into, now is a really, really great time. We normally try and do a bit of stuff that's a bit timely and then kind of throw in some general stuff as we've done today. We're going to try and do that, but we won't have the top opportunity to do the timely stuff. So evergreen content is great. What can we do? What can we talk about that you would like to hear about in some of those pre-recorded episodes? The plan, as always, Friday episodes will be those kind of topical conversations. We will do one on Bitcoin, unfortunately, because Andrew's made me promise we will. So there's one looked after. The Sundays will remain mailbag episodes as long as we have enough questions. So if you've got a question that's mailbaggy, throw it to us. If you've got a topic or a suggestion for what we can cover in some of those kind of big picture episodes, we'd love to know that too. As always, info@fool.com.au is how you can get them to us. While you're on the socials, jump onto Twitter. Andrew is at Strawman Invest is the company page, or at Sage_Simeon. You can grab me on Insta and Twitter at TMFScottP. The Motley Fool on Twitter and Insta at The Motley Fool AU. Facebook, I'm facebook.com/ScottPhillipsMoney, and you can get The Motley Fool at facebook.com/TheMotleyFoolAustralia. Please, throw us some ideas, because frankly, we're not that smart and can't come up with that many good ideas, so we're relying on you. Help us out. Help me, help you, help me help Andrew help you, and help us all not have to hear more about Bitcoin from Andrew. All right. Until then, fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.